Blog Talk Radio.
That means for tomorrow. I don't have to tell you. But anyway, it's April 14th, 2014, and this is Foxology Today. I am Silver Ray Fox, your host. Happy Monday to you. I hope it's a great day in your neighborhood. I'm here in Houston, and the weather is just so moody these days. We get sunshine, blue skies, and today not so much. A little overcast and gray out there, but nonetheless, it is a great day. Well, I've got a question for you. Have you ever failed at anything? Once, twice, or maybe even more? Have you ever felt like life has given you like way too many lemons? Have you found yourself getting in the way of your own success because of bad habits or even addictions? Have you struggled to stay on a steady road to success for whatever the reason? Well, none of those situations are uncommon for those who have achieved uncommon success. In fact, most successful people will tell you that is how and when they learn the most about how to become successful. If you're paying attention, those tough times can ultimately pay off in the success to come. Success seems to come, though, often by struggle in many cases. My guest today is a nationally known and sought-after author, radio host, happiness guru, and motivational speaker. He's appeared on CNN, CNBC, WNG TV. He's the author of Megamorphosis, How to Be Happier Right Now, Kill Talk, Thoughts After the First, Some Thoughts After My First Year in College, and Wealth Building in the 90s, What Wall Street Won't Tell You. He has been billed as the world's most successful failure, but don't let that play on words fool you. He has conquered almost every imaginable situation to reach incredible success. How does he do it? Well, it's because he's just one incredible guy. Please welcome Michael Juergen. Thanks so much for being my guest today, sir.
Oh, Silver Ray, it is my pleasure. And I got to tell you, I'm hearing you give that brief bio of me, and I'm thinking, who's she talking about? You know, this guy sounds wonderful. Then I realized you were talking about me. Thank you so much.
That's so kind. Yes, the one and only. Thank you so much. I'm excited to talk to you. You've got some great books out, Michael. I want to come out of the gates talking about those books. I love the title of Megamorphosis, How to Be Happier Right Now. You know, there's so much stuff always going on in the world and sometimes right in our own seats, and that's got to be a book that's been a huge hit. Tell us about where that idea came from.
I made up the name Megamorphosis, and I kind of stole the word metamorphosis from the Bible. Megamorphosis, which I coined, means great change, but taking it one step at a time – very slowly. And, you know, most people will tell you, and you know this, is that any type of change that you want to affect in your life minimally takes 21 days, because change has to actually internalize and become a habit. And so many people are so, you know, they're well-intentioned. I'm going to change. I'm going to go on a diet. I'm going to give up drinking. And when they say it at the moment, they mean it. It's kind of like a New Year's resolution. But then it doesn't really follow through. So the key is that I've always found you have to, and that's what I've been blessed to be able to help people internalize how to actually not, you know, just change their attitude, but to be happy and keep being happy and not backsliding, which we all tend to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, you do have to master the consciousness, otherwise you will find yourself in the wrong place and all too often. What about kill talk? What's that about?
Well, kill talk is interesting. That was a different genre for me, and that is a true story based on a love mafia story that took place in Chicago, Rhode Island, Florida. It's actually being made into a movie. But it was an interesting book because we had to change so many of the names because there were so many people that people would recognize, public figures and things like that. And it was actually very funny when I was writing it. Some of the people I knew became very paranoid. They said, you know, you're not going to use my name, are you, Michael? And I said, no, I would like to live a long life. You know, I'm not that naive. We'll protect the innocent and keep the guilty protected, too.
For sure. And then you have thoughts after the first. And why did you decide to go back and talk about some of the things that went on during your first year of college?
Well, it was a very volatile time, kind of young from your picture, but it was when Kent State was going on. There was a lot of people, college students, being killed. It was, you know, the time of Vietnam. And it was very interesting because actually I was writing for the school newspaper, and I wrote an article about the concept of in loco parentis shouldn't apply on a college campus. In other words, if a young man and a young woman want to visit each other in a dormitory for 10 minutes, which was forbidden then, my story was really that they should be allowed to. And it was very funny, Silver Ray, because I wrote this article, and the next day there was a rebuttal in the school paper from a Southern Baptist minister, never met him, and he called me a pervert and a sick person, and the article was titled Stolen Cake. And he talked about people should not even be together unless they're married. They're not even talking about, you know, in a physical way. I actually thought it was one of my friends playing a joke on me, and because who would write something, you know, this stupid? And he actually asked me to debate him on TV. So we went on TV, and we had a debate. The part of the debate became part of the book, and it was interesting because my cousin Danny Jurgen, who's won many Pulitzer Prizes, he's the smart one in the family. I'm the funny one. But he just won his first Pulitzer, published it with Random House. I sent the book to Random House absolutely thinking that they were going to publish it. They sent me the shortest rejection letter. It wasn't even three lines, but it basically said, you are the worst writer in the world and don't even bother us. As it happened, because the book was kind of controversial, the university they gave me a university car. They moved me to a Ramada Inn off campus. And, you know, I was 19 years old, so I said, sure, this is cool. So my writing career really started then, so I kind of lucked out, and then I've just had a lot of luck over the years.
No kidding. What a story. You also wrote Wealth Building in the 90s, What Wall Street Won't Tell You. And I would imagine a great deal of what you wrote then, principles still apply. But tell us about that book.
Wealth Building in the 90s was actually, that was my first bestseller. And when I say bestseller, most people don't realize most books never sell over 1,000 copies. And if a book sells, or what's called breaks midlist, 25, 50,000 copies, that's phenomenal. And I was just amazed that so many people were interested in it. But it was talking about the investment in numismatics, or rare coins, as an investment that had outpaced the stock market, real estate, everything else for years and years. And it was just a very interesting book, because it was a how-to book on how to invest, how to make money, whether you had $50 or $500,000. So again, I was very lucky. It was very well received by a lot of people all over the world.
Well, I do know, Michael, from just the brief conversation that we have had prior to the show and things that I've read on your website, you have gained over the years a tremendous amount of expertise in life, in what you do, what you have learned, and what you share, and certainly have become an authority and expert on the information that people get from your books and when they hear you speak. I particularly invited you today because I wanted to talk about something that it's a common topic, but it's taken a new level twist, and that's the topic of failure. You have been billed as the world's most successful failure, which I know is a play on words, because we know that you have become a great success and you're retired now, but you're still speaking and you charge phenomenal fees to consultant.
You're very sweet, but if you talk to my 97-year-old mother, she still says to me, when are you going to get a real job? You know, like with the railroad where you get a gold watch or something, you know. Thank you for that.
You've told her never, right?
I say, Mom, you know, I don't think so, but, you know, maybe someday if it makes you happy, I'll go work for the railroad for a day, you know.
Well, I think anybody who can charge $3,000 for a session, I'd say something good happened with that. But anyway, my question is leading to this. When I say about the popularity of the topic of failure, and I mentioned this in another show recently, that it used to be such a horrible place to find yourself in, because it was looked upon as, I mean, you know, the worst thing that could possibly, you tried something, it didn't happen, you built a business and it didn't work, your, you know, relationship, whatever the case may be, it was a bad word. But in more recent times, the script has been flipped, been redefined, because so many people who have become successes have revealed more and more about what a tough truck it was for them getting to where they needed to be, which were things that, for the most part, when the glitter and the shine was there, nobody asked any questions and nobody figured there were any pitfalls or hard places along the way.
You're absolutely right. You're right, Silver Ray, and it's all about perception. I mean, we used to think the world was flat. We used to think that failure was bad. I have always thought, and any successful person who I have ever met in any walk of life has never become successful unless they have failed a great number of times, because only by failing do you learn how to be stronger and how to keep going. And one of my first inspirations was a fellow named Leo Biscaglia. Leo was kind of the teacher to my friends Wayne Dyer and Martin Seligman and all the people in the happiness movement. And as a kid, he used to be on public television in Chicago, where I'm from, and he would get on stage and he would do the same thing. He would have all these, like, boxes tied to him. They'd all be tied to each other, and one box would say stress, and one box would say low self-esteem, and one box would say fear, and one box would say anxiety. And he would walk around the stage, you know, barely able to walk because he'd be carrying all these things with him, and then he would start to cut them one at a time, you know, freeing himself and walking quicker. And he would ask people in the audience questions. He would say, what does stress smell like? And people would be confused, and he'd say, what color is stress? The point being, they would understand that all of these emotions, these feelings, are creations of our own mind, and being creations of our own mind, we don't have to keep them. We can cut them loose and free ourselves. And he used to give this great example of how, you know, it's your choice to just decide that you want to be happy, and most importantly, internalizing it. You know, there's a great book out there that everyone's read by Rhonda, who's a great girl, The Secret. There were some authors, Wayne Dyer, some other people, friends of mine, that with all due respect to Rhoda, they didn't want to be in the book because they felt the book talked too much about just having positive manifestations, and that would change your life miraculously. And the real secret is you can have positive motivations all day long. That's not going to make you happy. That's not going to make you healthy. That's not going to make you wealthy or whatever your desires are. You have to really focus on what you want. And as the term megamorphosis, which comes from a Zen Kaizen phrase, you have to do it little bits at a time. Too many people try and do things too quickly, and nothing good ever happens quickly. Only bad things happen quickly. So you have to take time. You have to be patient. And most importantly, you have to be forgiving of yourself when you fail at something, and just realize there's some lessons to be learned which will make you stronger or wiser for the next endeavor.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Michael, do you recall when you first experienced failure in some of your own endeavors and how you handled that before you became more enlightened? How did you feel, and what was it that gave you the initiative and impetus to start looking at it differently?
It was, you know, and I was probably about 5 years old, and I don't know if I know I wasn't. I'm not that smart now. I wasn't that smart then. So I wasn't aware of really what was happening. But my older brother, who has since passed away, and he was born with brain damage and a slight cleft palate, and he used to have seizures all the time. And I can vividly remember walking home from school three, four times a week, and the streets would always be cordoned off with fire engines and police cars, and I knew what was happening. My brother was having a seizure, and my parents were true troopers, because every time his temperature would get to 105, they'd put him in the bathtub filled with ice, and then the helicopter would come to take him to Children's Memorial Hospital in Chicago. And coming home from school, it was a very depressing time, because even if the police and the fire and everyone wasn't around, I always, you know, knew, well, it's going to happen in the next day. And it was, you know, it was a big learning experience growing up, kind of taking care of my older brother. And it was very typical when I would get home, one of the neighbors would always try and take me aside so I wouldn't go home. I would be spared, you know, seeing my brother convulsing and everything. And they would always say, here, you know, have a cookie, which is one of the reasons I was a fat kid, because I ate too many cookies. But I think then, I won't say that I was depressed then, but I was scared. I was scared for my brother. And after a while, you know, you get used to anything. You really do. And, I mean, it was at the point where when my brother would have a seizure, the neighbors would not try and fatten me up with cookies. I'd be right there putting ice, you know, in the bathtub with them. And after a while, it just becomes the most normal thing in the world. And instead of being scared or frightened, your mentality changes, and all you're trying to do is make someone else feel better. And as we all know, it's really all about giving. It's what you do for other people that kind of earns you your moral stripes, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm. So from those experiences as a child, then you are saying that you had it ingrained in you then that you were more destined to find yourself in a situation where you would always want to be helpful and inspiring or motivating. Is that correct?
Right. And it was a little different because, you know, having an older brother, it was kind of a role reversal because I had to act as the older brother because people would pick on him, make fun of the way that he talked. So I really spent my whole life until he passed 6 years ago always trying to get him to be positive. It was just something, and he would fight it as hard as he could because he just felt he had been dealt a bad deck. And admittedly, he had a lot of problems, and he was born with a lot of problems, but I was relentless in trying to get him to just appreciate the little things. And occasionally I would get him to laugh, and he'd catch himself laughing and he'd stop it because, you know, that would show he wasn't in character with being miserable all the time. And I'm sure you know the Silver Ray. There are so many people that walk around that it's almost like they have the word victim written on their forehead, and they want people to feel sorry for them. And I call that the lobster mentality, because you have a pot of lobsters boiling, and one lobster tries to climb out to save his life. The other lobsters will pull that lobster back in. And there are so many people, unfortunately, and I'm sure you know, and I've read and I've listened to you a great deal, and you're a great role model, but I'm sure you know people that just constantly want you to come down to their level. And some do it overtly. And what a lot of people aren't aware of, there's people that do it, you know, they do it like almost covertly because they want to spread bad karma. And they feel better that other people are buying into their, you know, oh, woe is me, oh, woe is me. And the thing is, the only one that suffers when you feel like that is the person. And, you know, people can make great change. I'm a firm believer that they have to have, you know, whether it's God or a loved one or a good support group, you need to have people on your side because everyone is going to fail. And I say I fail every day, and I think you're so cute. You're giving me such praise about my books. I know my current book, Megamorphosis, my 97-year-old mother, who wants me to work for the railroad, she bought a copy. My sister bought a copy, and I think someone bought one by accident. So I know I've sold at least 3 copies, but I try to not have a big head about it.
Well, you know, at least you know. That's what I'm saying. And I'm sure that, you know, just talking about it more and more and more, you know, you're phenomenal with your sharing. And I'm sure there's a lot of information that will definitely impact lives now and for a long time. So if you had really only sold 3, which I'm sure you're exaggerating, I'm sure that over the years, books like that are a part of a movement, and they're you know, taken into history. You know, I still read the Power of Positive Thinking, and Enthusiasm Makes a Difference from Norman Vincent Peale. So from guys like you, they always stay with us. So I would guess, even with the success you have with it, the best still is yet to come. It's just wonderful to know that those seeds get planted in people who really want to get this, and, you know, what they become. You never know that in the numbers of, you know, people that you truly inspire and how you contributed to their success. But the great thing is knowing that that's the purpose of why you're doing it.
Go ahead, please.
I had asked about, you know, that being billed as the world's most successful failure, and you shared the story about your brother. I'm wondering if there were any business type of endeavors, perhaps, that you had approached, and what you were able to, you know, gather from that or learn some of your success tools at that point in time.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with, I remember being back in the 70s, being in the condo conversion business, and I got lucky again. I mean, I made let's just say, a lot of money in a very short time. And then I remember when interest rates changed in 2 weeks, I lost millions of dollars. I was like 20 years old. I was crying. I remember going to my father, and he said, what's the matter with you? I said, Dad, you know, I lost all this money. He said, well, you think you're the first one that's ever lost money? He says, pick yourself up, get out there, and get going, you know. But it's so, I think it's, you learn so much from the mistakes that you make. But I think in the end, Sober Ray, humor is always the best medicine. If you look at some of our great, great role models, Norman Cousins, who used to sit and watch the Three Stooges and funny movies, cured himself of every illness that he had. There is such a connection between the body and the mind, and people kind of take it for granted sometimes, you know. And I see, not to get off the subject, but I think technology is great and computers are great, although they're not always great for me. I'm not that patient. And I see people that, you know, in the old days, you would go to any city and you'd see kids playing stickball or baseball. You go anywhere now, you don't see anyone because everyone's on their computer. And, you know, that has to do with the obesity problem we're having. But more than that, so many people are so wired, with all due regards to Mr. Zuckerman, to Facebook and things, that in the last 2 years, the suicide rate among teenage girls between 14 to 17 has increased 76%.
Oh, my goodness.
There's two reasons. One is, some of my cohorts needlessly overprescribe drugs for people for too many reasons that they don't need them. But a lot of it has to do with, and I'm sure you're aware of this, is the bullying and the importance that people put on Facebook. I mean, literally, if a young girl, could be a boy too, wakes up and sees someone wrote a disparaging comment about them on Facebook, I don't have to tell you the number of people that have killed themselves because of that. And when I look at that, it makes me crazy. I go, you know, this is not good. Someone needs to do something. And actually, I'm working with some people from Stanford University where we're working a system where when you actually go on, it will actually pick up your biorhythm, so we'll know, we can tell people's happiness set point if they're happy. So even if someone says, oh, they're fine, we can actually see that they're not fine and try and help them. Because a lot of people, you know, that have, whether it's an alcohol problem or a weight problem or a problem with their spouse, a lot of people don't like to talk about their problems. It's considered weak. And how I always try and approach it is, you know, I try and open the door by talking about my own failures, my own mistakes, and then usually people will open up and start to be real. So many people are so concerned about what people will think about them, and the only person, as you know, Sober Ray, that matters about how you feel about yourself is yourself.
Yes.
And it's interesting,
yes,
there's
course.
A new study, and this was Mother Teresa was here in Scottsdale some years ago, and she was at one of our radio stations, and the station manager was so excited, you know, to have Mother Teresa as a guest, and he kept saying, Mother Teresa, what can I do? Anything you want, please. You know, I'm so honored to have you. What can I possibly do to repay you for your kindness for coming here? And I'll never forget, Mother Teresa looked at him and she said, go out on the streets of Phoenix at 3 o'clock in the morning and make some homeless person feel loved. Okay, you know, that was like, wow, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I guess she got to be Mother Teresa, you know.
Yes, of course, of course. Well, that's, you know, generally not what people are thinking they should do to find their own happiness, powerful step in the right direction. I agree totally with you about the whole idea of just giving of yourself and giving in general is just one of the most joyous ways to live out in any day. I want to ask you about the overcoming the failure and success steps or strategies. I wrote down humor as a number one thing because you brought that up in just the last few minutes. And I believe that that can actively play a huge role in overcoming all and cutting away the things that you had mentioned that Leo Buscaglia had done, the stress, the anxiety, and things like that, and helping to put things, I think, in a perspective. Although, you know, it's very hard to say if you've lost your money and you've lost your business. Oh, well, okay, guess that's over with. Let's try something new. It's not quite as easy to, you know, say, ha, ha, ha. Most of us want to be laughing all the way to the bank and not, you know, looking at losses and thinking that. But it's definitely a step in the right direction. I know, as you have said, there are many who take that approach just to eliminate the stressors and to begin to get, you know, bearings on their emotions. What would you say are some other things to do for overcoming the whole failure barrier?
Well, number one, you have to have hope. Number two, I'm a big believer in creative visualization. And one of the most famous guys, a fellow named Viktor Frankl, who was in a concentration camp at Auschwitz, who saw his whole family killed right before him, he mm-hmm. became one of the most amazing role models, because even in these terrible conditions, being in death camps, he would constantly try and think of funny things. He learned how to play golf. He never played golf, but he would practice in his mind. And when he got out mm-hmm. of the concentration camp, he was a great golfer. So, you know, when people lose money, the thing is, if you're walking down the street, someone looks at you, they don't know you lost money. It's you that knows it. It's you that feels badly. And the reality is, it's just, you know, it's just a stepping stone, and everything happens for a reason. I mean, I really, really, really believe that. And it's hard. I'm not saying when you lose, you know, when you lose your money or you lose your job or, you know, you lose a loved one, that you just magically, you know, turn on the smile and it's a big panacea to help everyone. Sometimes you have to go through the suffering and the pain, but it's what you do with it. Do you use it to disable you and immobilize you, or do you get to the point, which most people usually do, where they say, you know what, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, a very interesting study, because as I'm sure you know, everyone is born with a happiness set point, and 50% of it is at birth. You are born with, you know, either anywhere from 50 to 100% happiness. The good news is that anyone can change their happiness set point. So the other 50%, you can control that. You can change that. And a lot of people don't realize that. And the thing is, that has nothing to do with hereditary. That's totally up to you. And if people surround themselves with positive people, with mentors, with like-minded people, it's amazing how through osmosis that will start to rub off on you. And I'll ask people, for example, I'll say, you know, what's the last good book you read or good inspirational book? And they go, oh, I haven't picked up a book in 25 years. I haven't had time. And you know, and it's so sad. Someone doesn't read books. Or, do you know, the average person now watches TV 9 hours a day? I mean, that's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So I think part of being happy is being engaged in life. It's kind of hard. I mean, I'm fortunate. I live in beautiful Scottsdale. It's 89 degrees today. The weather's always beautiful. And as when we first got on the phone before we went on the air, you said, how are you, Michael? And I said, every day above ground is a good one. And I do. I wake up every day and I go, wow. Another day. What am I going to do with it? Okay. And then, you know, you go through day, and years ago, I used to do a thing called EST and Echelon training, and we would have people come together on a, like, for the weekend. They would get together on a Friday night, and they would stay the whole weekend, and typically Friday, strangers getting together were, you know, a little tenuous, a little standoffish, because they didn't know each other. By Saturday, people would be, you know, on the floor crying, talking about how when their mother didn't give them the birthday cake when they were five, it scarred them. It was very cathartic. Mm-hmm. And on Sunday when people would leave, everyone would be on this great high. They would be happy. They would be in spirit, connected with themselves and the universe. The sad part was is that because I would follow up with people, a little thing called life would get in the way, and where people would go to work Monday and their cohorts would say, wow, Sober Ray, you look great. You look fantastic. I mean, what's happened? There's a visible change about you. And by the end of the week, as high and as, you know, positive as people were, oftentimes they'd be right back where they started almost a week ago. So, you know, that's what I kind of figured. There's got to be ways to make permanent, lasting change. And the only way to do it, it's like when people are married for 50 years and people say, oh, my God, how have you done that? And they'll give you, you know, if they're being honest, they'll give you a simple answer. They go, I work at it every day. And work doesn't have to be arduous. You know, work can be fun. Work can be passionate.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds great. I wrote down a few things, and if there's more, let's go ahead and add it before we wrap. But I wrote down, I kept humor on the list because it's so powerful, and having hope, of course, having to have an optimistic approach to what's beyond failure. And then the creative visualization, that's very powerful as well. You got to see what you want. And I like how you said about the change, creating permanent change. We can't always control everything, but definitely we can work at creating more positive change in our life. And then you said engaging in life as well. And, you know, I've heard many people say this more recently too, just waking up in the morning and appreciating that you are a part of another day and that it's an opportunity to do something that's worthwhile.
Well, I think Einstein said it best. Einstein said, you can either look at nothing as a miracle or the whole world is a miracle. And just to finish one of my thoughts, because I have a tendency to interrupt myself, and I'm a Gemini, I have 12
right
personalities,
ahead.
But we all travel together, so we all get along now, so that's good.
Well, that's
a good thing. It is, but they've done studies now. I was talking about the happiness set point, where they take quadriplegics who've come back from Afghanistan and things like that. Do you know that in 18 months, those people are as happy as they were before anything happened? Everyone gets back to their set point. And it's an amazing, amazing concept, and I think a lot of it has to do with you have to engage people that you normally would not. My best example of that, anytime I see anyone in a wheelchair or with a cane or with some malady, whether it's MS or this or that, I always go up to them, and I always say, what is the matter with you? And people are so thrilled that instead of turning the other way, you know, and pretending like they don't exist, that you actually go up to them and talk to them, their whole face lights up. And that is one of the easiest things to do. So if you're feeling sorry for yourself, go visit a hospital or go see homeless people. Go see people who really, you know, are at the bottom and look at how well they're doing. And then shame on you if you know, you can't get yourself in a better place. But you got to be careful because a lot of people beat themselves up. You know, people will go on a diet and they'll do good for 3 days, then they slip up and then they go, oh, well, you know, I'm fat, I'll never be able to lose weight. And they forget about it instead of just saying, okay, I slipped up today, but I'm going to start tomorrow and, you know, keep mm-hmm. doing it. And it's very mm-hmm. interesting. There's a study that was done. It's actually had to do with Mother Teresa. And it's well known that if someone does a good deed, they feel better. But what research has discovered is that even someone observing someone doing a good deed makes that person feel better too. So it's really all about, you know, you have a choice to go out there and, you know, most people in their own way, you know, I mean, like you lead through what you do, and everyone knows how passionate you are about what you do. It's not work, and the way you impact people's lives is, you know, is a blessing. I mean, we're blessed to have someone like you around, and I'm sure you touch so many people's lives, you know, both subtly, directly, indirectly, and everyone has, you know, everyone doesn't have to be a famous radio star like you to do it. There's little things that you can do, you know, to, and it's all about giving. It really is.
Well,
and you're not thinking about yourself.
Yes. Well, thank you for saying that, because that's been the premise and the purpose foundation that I've built my life on. I've done it all my life with understanding that that's what really makes a difference, is how you can influence, impact, or help someone. And it's been the most incredible thing for me, especially, and I'm sure like you, when people come back to you years later, you see someone, happen to see someone, and they want to give you, you know, all the credit, which I never really do accept, but it's just an amazing thing to know that the things that we do on a daily basis can contribute to, you know, actions now and actions and success in others later. It's more than a, I mean, it's very humbling. It's a privilege to be able to
work
in that way.
You speak it so well. You're so indicative of it, because I do a lot of work with people with addictions, and people, I could show anyone how to quit any addiction, but take cigarettes, for example. People, say someone's smoking two packs a day, the hardest part, nicotine is out of, it's an insidious drug, but it's out of your system in 3 days. What people don't realize, if they smoke two packs a day, they're taking that cigarette and putting it hand to mouth almost 800 times a day. So it's this Pavlovian response that's emblazoned on your brain. That's why people gain weight. That's why people, you know, drink coffee. And it's not, it's because they've quit smoking, but they haven't quit, they haven't gotten the patterns out of their mind. So in order to change, you have to really decide that you want to do something different, and not begrudgingly. You have to do it because it feels good, and that's its own reward.
Yes, for sure, for sure. Well, there's one more question I want to ask you about the whole direction of success, and again, it's because I know a lot of people experience it. And what would you say for people who are in the process of trying to make lemonade out of their lemons right now?
Wow, well, that's a great question. And I think it has to do with, do you look at the glass half empty or half full? And I hate to be one of those like, you know, super duper happy people that says, oh, so you lost your job, you lost your money, oh, don't despair, you'll be fine. No, you're in a terrible position. It's catastrophic. It's devastating. But you have to know that it will get better, unless you want to just, you know, surround yourself, you know, with negative thoughts. Sometimes the worse it gets, you know, you almost have to say to yourself, okay, God, how much more can you do? I mean, aren't I ready for a break? And then miraculously, all of a sudden things start. And believe me, there's days where I have great days, and you know this, you can meet one person who's negative, and even though we try not to let people like that affect us, it's something like, I don't know, they get in your skin or something, and all of a sudden, 10 minutes later, you're wondering why you're not feeling so good, and you're thinking, ah, it was because I was with that negative person. Okay, so,
mm-hmm.
you know, when things
mm-hmm.
are really, really, really tough, okay, you just have to, have faith, and you most important, you have to have faith in yourself and not beat yourself up. People don't fail usually because they did something wrong. And, you know, maybe they just, it was timing, or maybe it was the economy. I mean, I could tell you a quick story. A friend of mine from Chicago, he had about $20 or $30 million in 08 when the world kind of came to an end financially. He lost a couple $100,000, which did not affect him at all. But because of his ego, which is, you know, ego always gets in the way, he went and he killed himself, and he left 4 beautiful children behind because his ego could not handle you know, this loss. Now, that's ridiculous. You know, if I said, Silver Ray, you have $22 million and you lost $200,000, you're feeling suicidal, I would say shame on you.
Yes,
you know,
of course.
People take to heart different things, and so much of it has to do with how we've grown up, how we've been raised. And I think a big thing when we fail is we're thinking back to when our parents were raising us and all the rules we were taught, how to live your life right, how to accomplish things. And the reality is the only person you have to worry about that's being happy is yourself. And I counsel a lot of people that are in careers, lawyers, doctors, and they hate it. But they never had the guts to tell their parents that I'm going to go write poetry or I'm going to go ride horses in Montana, because they would be considered weird or out of place. And, you know, I'm all for those people. I go yay to the people that, you know, like Walden, who spent all those years on Henry David Thoreau spent all those years on Walden Pond just communing with nature. A lot of people thought he was crazy. I thought, wow, that would be cool.
Mm-hmm. Well, that really is great. I see, you know, it's our attitude and approach. We got to watch our attitude and approach on a daily basis, and that's what it boils down to. And by you mentioning too about the negative people and circumstances we can find ourselves around, and awareness and being able to recognize and shake that off too, and realize that it's in our ability to be able
absolutely
to do that.
Absolutely. And it's,
Michael,
it's people helping people too. I started 40 years ago a nonprofit called Project Empathy, which is really mm-hmm. nothing more than people all over the world. If they have a problem, they pick up the phone, they call someone, they say, hey, I'm having a down moment. That person will talk them out of it in a minute or two. And people have been doing that now for years. And it sounds simple, but it works. You got it. You have to have support groups. You have to have people around you that are going to, you know, when you're not as strong or when things are going bad for you, hang around the people, you know, that have failed more than you that are now successful, and they will teach you a lot.
Absolutely. Michael, tell us a little bit more about how people can reach out to Project Empathy and where they can learn more about you and people who may desire to have your consultation services or have you come and speak.
Sure. Well, they can call my mother, and she'll tell you, don't call. If I want them to work for the railroad, leave them alone. Or no, you can reach me at my number is 312-952 Love, L-O-V-E, which spells 5683. I don't employ secretaries. I have many psychiatrists and people on my staff, but I answer my own phone. And otherwise, people can go on my website. I think it's michaeljurgen.tv. And what I tell people, I have a lot of people that call me, and they go, well, Michael, you know, I don't know if I can afford you this or that. Most of what I do is usually people are, if I have a free session with them, most people are smart enough to get from the free session so they don't have to pay me a dime. So I'm a big believer in that, you know.
And that's probably why you have done as well as you have, because giving like that, again, as I said earlier, can pay off so big for you ultimately. You've got a heart of gold. And I want to thank you so much for taking time to share with us. Your stories are inspiring. Your insights are invaluable. And I appreciate the knowledge that you have given to me today, even, and to people who are listening. And I wish you the most best and blessed future going ahead. I know people like you always say they're retiring. I guess it just sounds good saying that, but maybe you have slowed your momentum a bit, but I know that rarely means anything,
you know,
as far
I
as what
you ever,
love
to
do.
I don't think you ever retire. I've retired 2 or 3 times. It usually lasts about an hour. Yes, thank
goodness for all of us.
That's right. That's right.
Thank goodness.
Silver Ray,
for all
it has been
us.
My absolute delight to talk to you. I'm a big fan of you, and I'm so proud of you for all the great work and the great message that you send out there to people, because people really need you, and we're really appreciative of you.
And it's likewise. And I want to thank all of you listeners for tuning in today, and hasn't this been awe-inspiring? Of course, it really has. I've been talking to Michael Yergin. He is the author of Megamorphosis, his newest book, How to Be Happier Right Now. Right now sounds like a good idea, so why don't you check him out at Michael Yergin TV and look into getting that book as well, because you can be happier right now.
Yeah,
stay with
happier
me this
too,
week.
If you're gonna buy it on Amazon, I think you could buy it used. It's only like $3. Don't pay retail for it. Okay, save money. Get it for as cheap as
you can. It'll be the best $3 investment you've made. So I agree. Go ahead and look it up on Amazon.com, as Michael has suggested, and pay attention to what I'm doing for the rest of the week. I do have another guest coming up on another special episode of Foxology Today, someone who took a creative idea to another level. So you'll want to keep your eyes peeled for that. In the meantime, I want to thank you again for listening. I'll look forward to talking to you next time. Have a great day.